Hello and welcome to Platforms and Pitfalls. I'm Rowan and this is a short pre-episode announcement. I made some mistakes with my microphone settings and so you might notice that the sound quality is a little bit off. I apologize about that. I hope you enjoy the episode regardless. Enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to Platforms and Pitfalls. I'm Rowan.
And I'm Jack.
And we're going to talk about game design today because we think game design is cool and worth talking about. You might notice that Jack is not blue. Blue couldn't make it to be with us today, but who are you?
I am a writer who lives way up in the rural north of Japan, but I'll be moving down to Tokyo and back to civilization in a few months.
I'm moving to civilization too in a few months, which is very exciting. But we're here to talk about five different games that approach a game design topic. This month, we're looking less at classical game design and more strongly at narrative, specifically open worlds. Open world games have been on a rise since the PS2 era with Grand Theft Auto 3, and we've seen it mature in a lot of different ways, and it's become sort of a very ubiquitous genre today. Traditionally, though, this genre's always had a sort of conflict between how we traditionally tell stories and how open world games tend to be played and structured, and that's what we're sort of looking to explore today. We're going to aim to talk about these games in broad strokes so as not to spoil the plots of them. However, since we are talking about narrative, it's inevitable that we're going to spoil them in some way for you, so if you're very sensitive about spoilers, maybe this isn't the right episode for you. So our first game is Horizon Zero Dawn. A 2017 open-world action RPG by Guerrilla Games, beautiful and critically acclaimed for its storytelling and striking, verdant post-apocalyptic setting. It's sort of an example of what an open-world game is. It's very traditional in a lot of ways, but it's a very effective use of this genre and medium. You are particularly passionate about this game. What really strikes you about it and made you want to talk about it with us?
Yeah, so the reason I pushed for this to sort of be our baseline, I kind of think of Horizon Zero Dawn as like the best margarita pizza in the world. It doesn't really do anything completely bonkers or inventive with the genre, but what it does do is it takes those conventions of the genre and it does them really, really well to make it a really tight finished product by the end.
It seems to tell its story in like a lot of very conventional video gamey ways. Do you think that its story succeeds in part of being open world or sort of in spite of being open world?
I definitely think it's part. So the story of Horizon Zero Dawn, trying not to spoil things too much, you follow Aloy, who is, I think, about 17. Her adoptive father is an outcast from her tribe, the Nora. And the Nora are very sort of hidden away in their own sacred lands. There are a few other tribes that you're sort of aware of in this world, but you are basically an outcast within already a very isolated area. So the story is you and Aloy together coming from a position where you know practically nothing about the world, suddenly catapulted into it, learning about the nature of the world that you're inhabiting and also what's going wrong with it that will necessarily drive sort of the ultimate plot. That sense of exploration, I think, works really well with open world game design, which obviously is very focused on player freedom, being able to see something, the classic, I think it's from Skyrim, isn't it? See the mountain, go there. See the enormous robot T-Rex, go there and get killed by instantly. That sort of thing. So yeah, the sense of exploration, I think, really ties in very well with it. It's not especially unconventional in its structure. You've still got some towers, basically, which will reveal bits of the map, which is sadly littered with icons. These, in this case, are sort of enormous robot giraffes that you climb up and hack, which is pretty fun. It's got main quests, which serve the story pretty directly and will be put at different areas around the world to try and take you on a bit of a whistle-stop tour of the interesting parts, and which will advance the story, but sort of wait for you there. And you've got side quests, which generally will come to you when you talk to an NPC where the conversation is optional, where you don't need to talk to that person. These will sometimes give you rewards and often help flesh out the world. That's something that I think is really well done here, is everything serves your greater understanding of the world. There are many, many collectibles which are often audio logs or holograms or text files and stuff like that of this world, which is sort of recognizably ours, but you have no idea really how long ago it was and what happened. And same with your side quest, you learn more about the people inhabiting the world right now and the nature of the world that you're exploring.
So a lot of open world games tend to have a lot of lore that's very elaborate and convoluted, maybe. Do you feel that a lot of the lore in Horizon Zero Dawn exists in order to have lore to reveal, or like it's lore that is there because it genuinely needed to be there?
That's
which is a very like loaded question, I guess.
I'd say so. I mean, it's something we'll hopefully come back to in some other games, but I think a lot of the lore, you could almost split it into two halves. You could see the side quests, which are generally dealing with human people existing in the world, in the present, as it were, of the game, which seems to be far future Earth, maybe. And so that lets you understand more about what the world is, but also as you progress through the story and you start to come across sort of the main conflict and what it is the game is about, in inverted commas, it sort of reveals to you the stakes of what you're fighting to save and what you're fighting for. Then the other half is mainly in things like text logs, but not exclusively, and sort of collectibles that you'll find, which are often remnants of this world that you know seems to have existed in the very distant past. And learning more about that world and what was lost, and sometimes some details of what led to the events that you're in now, though a lot of those tend to come up in the main story beats. So it's certainly not impossible to just play through the story missions and get a sense of the broad idea of the story and the narrative, but you're definitely missing out quite deliberately on a lot of what really makes the game feel very rich and alive.
A part of the appeal of Horizon Zero Dawn was like it's the aesthetics itself and like exploring this like cohesively beautiful world that still has this like sense of being like a remnant of something past.
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting to look at the machine design for something like this, where if you've seen any screenshots, you will have, I'm sure, seen the sort of enormous crumbling cities or tanks with moss grown over them and stuff like that, compared to the sort of acting machines that you come across, which are gleaming white metal, very organically inspired. They're not at all sort of the boxy cars and broken roads and stuff like that. I think it's a really well done and naturalistic way of giving a sense that these machines, they aren't just like some hoovers that got sentience and started being a bit dangerous to people. There's something about these that makes them very different. They act like animals, and as well as being based off organic forms. And sometimes you'll get a bit of a sense of events that you stumble across, bandits raiding them or hunters trying to kill machines and stuff like that, which really gives a sense of the world as a cohesive ecosystem, basically, or, you know, a world in itself, quite apart from what you're doing in it.
I'm thinking of you, actually. So you mentioned Aloy is an outcast. To me, like, so a lot of open world games have that focus on doing a lot of small side quests for people. It sounds at first glance like it's sort of counterintuitive, like why are they going to an outcast for their help? Do you feel that is a sort of bit of lunar narrative dissonance? Like, is it a contrast that doesn't match well, or does it actually enhance things?
So the whole dynamic of Aloy being an outcast is something that it's explored a lot in the very early game. The so-called sacred lands of your tribe are areas that you can move about in relatively freely. Most people aren't allowed to talk to you because you are sort of an outcast by association, because your father is, but it's sort of unclear to everyone how much that reflects onto you as the character. So at first, you actually have real trouble. There's one merchant who will talk to you, and only very, very covertly, from whom you can buy things, for example. But the story is such that when you sort of come out of this introductory bit and you start to leave the sacred lands, necessarily you go from being an outcast to something of a representative of your tribe. That's not so much explored through the game design, but definitely in the narrative and storytelling itself. That's a really big aspect of Aloy's character, of being the sort of representative of a tribe and being judged as a member of a tribe that actually she's never felt she was a part of, because she's been shunned for her entire life.
So I guess what we're saying here is that the world really supports this fairly traditional narrative, but it is like bringing all these traditional open world elements and using them all to enrich this fairly linear traditional narrative, as opposed to being oppositional to it like it can feel in some open world games.
Yeah, ones that we will, I'm sure, talk about later. It's Yeah, it very much takes a very naturalistic and sort of realist approach, where, for example, Aloy has levels and her weapons have stats, but really what's growing is Aloy as a character, along with the player, as she comes across new machines, for example, and almost invariably gets absolutely flattened by them as soon as she sees them. But, you know, you learn more about weaknesses, for example, and strategies. The game's very good at giving you a lot of different strategies and allowing you to work out what works best for you, as it might, you know, in as much as we can imagine being in a situation like this, as a real human being might, rather than forcing you down a certain route or giving you a single very, very powerful bow, which you would only ever use, you know, once you get to the end of the game.
I think our next game has a little bit more raw mechanical improvement as opposed to player-based improvement with the open world of Final Fantasy XV. Final Fantasy XV is a 2016 open-world RPG by Square Enix, famous for its development hell and originally starting life as part of the Final Fantasy XIII Fabula Novus Crystallis thing. It's a very messy game, and so our conversation about it is inherently going to be a bit messy. It's going to be very spoilery as well, most likely. I will edit in a timestamp later for when we're going to talk about our next game, but for now, assume that there are going to be lots of spoilers ahead. We'll warn you when they get more specific as we go on. And the story is vaguely featuring a prince and his friends as they go on a road trip after the prince's kingdom is mostly gone.
Yeah.
That's a very really simplified summary, but that's about right, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
And this was literally, like, I told you I had a podcast and you were like, I want to talk about Final Fantasy 15.
I'm really glad you invited me to, well, kind of followed through with all of this, because I have run out of fingers to count on for how many people at parties or evenings or just strangers on the street I have stopped for like 45 minutes to just talk at about, by the way, here are all my thoughts about Final Fantasy 15. So I'm glad I've now got this that I can just point people to.
So 45 minutes is a bit long, so you're going to have to like condense it down, but go.
I'll do my best. So Final Fantasy 15, it's when we're talking about narrative and we're talking about its genre, I suppose we'd call it, the open world, it's really a game of two stories. And I think, as we mentioned in very briefly in our Horizon Zero Dawn part, one of the stories has a really strong sense of ludonarrative dissonance. The game mechanics and the gameplay don't really match with the story that's being told. That's one of the stories. And the other story, I think, is really interesting because it has a very strong sense of ludonarrative harmony, I think we decided, or ludonarrative unity, where it does actually fit very nicely with the gameplay.
And that part is like the core band of the four characters, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the main story of Final Fantasy 15 is already kind of all over the place. We were talking a little bit about this beforehand, weren't we? That it's got the main game, a feature-length film, an audio drama, a manga, possibly, definitely an anime, two demos, and I think a book coming out, as well as about four DLC episodes. That's a lot of homework to do.
Five DLC episodes. We just got episode Arden.
Yes, we did. So that's a lot of fragments to be piecing together. Unfortunately, in the story itself, in the main game rather, you've also got to be piecing together some things. So here's probably where things are going to get a bit more spoilery, so be warned. If we follow the sort of broad beats of the story, you start off with your three friends, you as Noctis, Prince of the Kingdom of Lucis, we love Latin names in this game, going off to marry Lunafreya as part of a treaty with the Empire of Niflheim. Lucis and Niflheim have been at war for many centuries, and this will hopefully end everything. As described by the film Kingsglaive, Niflheim uses this treaty signing ceremony as an opportunity to ambush Lucis and destroy the whole capital city of Insomnia, killing the king and leaving Noctis as the presumed dead, now king of Lucis, ready to try and get his kingdom back. We're going to start this off with finding some magical weapons, then we're going to try and awaken some gods, and finally it's going to come out that one of the members of the sort of highest orders of Niflheim's government is actually a sort of demon king who has really got it in for you and wants to kill you in order to plunge the world into eternal night. So a pretty standard Final Fantasy story going on. The problem I think that is we are faced with almost immediately is one of urgency. So something that I think is almost a joke that gets made about open world games a lot is that the world needs to be saved. I've seen this a lot with Breath of the Wild. The world needs to be saved. Let's go and go fishing. Let's go and spend 10 hours collecting every single apple in the world and make it into a pile.
Yeah, this is particularly problematic in Skyrim, very famously.
Yes.
Because a lot of like, this dragon is going to destroy the world. We have to run there now. And you just become leader of a school.
Yeah.
In the meantime.
I'm going to go off and become a mage for 10 hours. Like, that's always a problem that open world games, I think, need to really balance very carefully in their game design. And 15, in its main story, just doesn't really do this. Because you start off ready to go on what's meant to be quite a relaxed road trip, and suddenly your city's in flames and you're constantly being ambushed by enemy soldiers. And yet you can still just sort of go fishing. And there's obviously a difference in can and should, but it still feels really, for me, when I was playing it, it felt really sort of almost uncomfortable. I didn't want to be doing any side quests because the side quests, unlike for something like Horizon Zero Dawn, the side quests teach you a little bit about the world and they give you some fun goodies, but they don't really serve the story. Only the story missions serve the story. And given that this story is quite an urgent one, the main driving force is to keep doing the story missions, by which point there's almost no point having an open world surrounding that, you know?
And that's definitely like a big tension, but it doesn't help that a lot of people don't respond well to this particular story. Like in discussions about this game, generally the core narrative is not even discussed.
I think part of that is because of the really fragmented nature of the whole storytelling, which personally, with absolutely nothing to back this up, but this is my conjecture, is that the fact that it was 10 years between announcement and release has something to do that they needed to, they maybe felt they needed to sort of drip feed a little bit of the story to people and then assumed people had already watched the film. Drip feeding the story with things like the film and the demos, I think, took away from a lot of the power of the game's story when you actually came to play it. We're fragmenting the story between these things. To me, it felt like this overarching story, it just doesn't match up with the game that you're actually playing, which is meant to be, here's a whole great world to explore with some interesting looking monsters to kill. Off you go and explore it. But there's no reason really to do that because your whole kingdom hasn't even stopped smoking yet. And you're kind of ready to awaken some gods and turn into the chosen king of legend and stuff like that. It's interesting that you say as well that the main narrative isn't really discussed. I think part of that actually points us quite nicely onto the second narrative, as it were, which is Noctis, Prompto, Gladiolus, and Ignis, wonderfully Latin-y names, sort of being together on this road trip. And that, I think, is really well suited to the kind of game that you're playing, particularly in the sort of first half, as it were, the open world section. As we talked a little bit before with Horizon Zero Dawn, for me, I really like the idea that open world stories are about exploration. And while a really sort of clear way of doing that is by literally making it about exploration, here's a mysterious world, go and find out more about it, you can also do that by exploring characters. There are a lot of mechanics in Final Fantasy XV from, say, the battle system, which really emphasizes cooperation, even though you're with AI characters, or using rest stops and camps as times for sort of side cutscenes, which really mean that by the end of the game, you are very close to these other characters and you really feel the bond between them. The sort of words brotherly love were thrown around quite a lot in a lot of the marketing material as well. And I think that, if anything, is sort of the main story of Final Fantasy XV. It's one much better suited to an open world game where you can generally be assumed to take your time, maybe do things again, do what interests you, and thus feel like these characters have come on the same journey that you have, rather than sprinting to the end in order to save the world, which notably, I think that part of the story is explored and developed a lot more in the sort of second half, where the game becomes a lot more linear, which was sometimes a bit controversial among reviewers.
The way that people talk about the dynamics between the characters echoes discussions that are more similar to games like Persona, actually, like people having like distinct favorites and like character moments that they really liked about these characters that are not about the plot per se, but really like other things people took away from the experience. And there's a sort of almost Otome game-esque feeling to the experience. I don't know if you've played many Otome games.
I have not.
Having a collection of handsome chaps that where most of the pleasure of the experience is hanging out with them, getting to know them, it reminds me of some of the more pleasant Otome experiences that I've had. Otome games are dating sims aimed at women, for context. Because I assume that most of our audience does not just know that genre name off the top of their heads.
Well, they do now. But yeah, you can really see that, I think, in the amount of care that's taken over, for example, the voice acting, I think is really stellar in this game. For a game that is so messy in so many ways, the voice acting is really, really excellent. And for example, having to stop and make camp, and then in the background of your save screen and stuff like that, you'll have, for example, Noctis and Prompto fiddling about with his camera and taking some silly photos in the background. Some of the side quests will be, again, to use a very similar example, Prompto will see a famous lookout and he'll want to go and take a photo of you all. The photos, I think, are a really good sort of almost symbol of all of this, that you build them up as you go. Some, they're almost all taken automatically.
And there's a great article on Gamma Sutra about like how that camera AI works, and I think a GDC video that I will put in the show notes because it's a really incredible piece of work.
Yeah. And it's a really standout bit of the game, I think, that the game makes quite a big part of, not only in the side quests, but every time you sort of stop for the night, you get to go over the day's photos and save the ones you want.
This loop of camping, photos, sort of looking over the day is something like most open world games tend to have this, even though they're about like taking your time and being broad, it's always about always going forwards. The photo album to me really makes 15 about looking back on the journey. Like it's always about like, oh, we're resting for the night. It feels like chatting about the day almost, even though the game obviously doesn't have you doing that. But just looking over the photos makes it more, you're more prompted to remember what you did in each session, I think, which is really rare for this genre. And I think it's very distinctive.
And I think it's really telling that a lot of the time, often tongue planted firmly in cheek, this game is referred to as a road trip. Which it is, you're driving around in a car with your friends, but the word road trip has this connotations of you're having fun, you're going on a bit of a sort of adventure with a small A and getting into some japes. That isn't how you would describe it if you took the game away and just described the main overarching story, which is very dark, end of the world, kill God with your teenage friends kind of classic Final Fantasy fare. You know, I think that's really significant, that the thing that stands out to people is actually the collection of all these smaller moments, and that's I think because it interacts a lot better with the genre, whereas the overarching story kind of fights against the genre and exists despite it.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of that thing of like the function of time in terms of getting attached to things is really important to this sort of experience, like getting to know characters. And I think traditional narrative structures just don't gel well with really long games, even though famously RPGs are really long and are the story genre.
And a lot of the time, though, in games, your characters don't need to eat, they don't need to sleep. You know, that's sometimes sort of made fun of, particularly in games that pertain to be very realist. I finished The Last of Us a few months ago, and that, you know, you will break for the night, but it will do that in between levels. It's not really a thing that your character needs to think about, eating and sleeping. Whereas in this game, it is, because you get very real bonuses from eating certain things, for example, which the game is noticeably harder without doing. And the characters will start to complain if you've been driving all night that they really just want to break. It's a real testament to how well crafted that bit is, that they managed to make a real mechanic of that. And it interacts so well with the characters.
And yeah, it's not just a mechanic. It makes Ignis, the character that does the cooking, he seems like a bit strict and harsh maybe at points. And so it sort of makes him feel a bit more like homey and motherish. Gladios and Ignis are kind of the parents of the group in some sense. And Ignis doing the cooking kind of enforces that a little bit more, and also provides these distinct mechanical bonuses too, which I think is a very interesting balance of things.
Exactly. Or Noctis complaining that he hates camping and Gladio telling him to shut up, you know, but there is a difference between stopping at a hotel and camping, for example. So it lets you, I suppose, to some degree role play, depending on whether you want Noctis to be in charge of this all or not. It also, again, it gives this feeling of realism that you're also all on a journey together. And you know, in our general understanding of linear time, it gets light and dark at different times of a 24-hour period, and you do need to stop and eat at times. It's something that a lot of games, and again, particularly open-world games, I think, are a bit bad at doing. Even if they do have, say, a day-night cycle, there's rarely any reason to stop and sleep, unless it's something like in Skyrim, you need to pass the time, or, you know, something like that.
But in that case, generally in Skyrim, like, time is just a nuisance.
Yeah.
It's never a thing that you play around. It's more like, oh, it's the wrong time, I'm just going to stand in the street for 10 hours and wait for the shop to open.
Yeah, exactly. I think there could be so much said about even just the camping mechanic behind Final Fantasy XV, even beyond its implications for narrative, because so much of, I think, the good parts of the game ultimately end up centering around the camping. You're looking over your photo.
Yeah, that loop of hunt, camp, explore, hunt, camp, explore.
Exactly. Training against each other, for example, fighting Gladiolus as sparring practice, which lets you grow as a player and get better, is also something that I think is all really, really well done to make these characters feel like humans going on a journey. But the problem is the focus narratively is so much on them, and particularly in the open world section, you're basically only spending your time with these other three characters doing this gameplay loop, that the story, capital S, kind of all needs to be thrown back into this second section where everything gets a lot tighter. You're not really free to pick where you go. And it also, I think, leads to a lot of the secondary characters, even people like the main antagonist, being quite underdeveloped. Thus, we need DLC episodes, you know?
So I think we've gone for a while on this topic. Is there anything that you want to finish up on before we transition to our next game?
No, I think that's all pretty much fine.
Okay, and so we talked a bit about 15, like part of the appeal of 15 being like a function of time. We're looking at a game that sort of takes on a function of empty time, I guess. Our next game looks at sort of a function of empty space in a little bit of a different way. We're looking at Breath of the Wild. A 2017 Nintendo EPD title that launched alongside the Switch and is credited in part to the machine's initial success. Breath of the Wild is an open-world Zelda game that opens up the formula quite a bit, with a great focus on exploration, experimentation, and a highly dynamic environment and physics system. So it's interesting Zelda on this list because compared to the other two games so far, in terms of the like direct narrative it tells you, it's not that interesting. Like, it's a fairly typical hero's journey in the past tense, and a lot of open world games tend to use the past tense story as their telling structure because urgency is a really big issue in these sorts of games.
That was really one of the fundamental problems with 15, and one of the things that Horizon Zero Dawn managed to avoid. And I do think it's really interesting with Zelda. We were talking about this just a little bit before the episode, how we definitely need a spoiler warning for 15, and even then we didn't really talk very much about the story. For Zelda, it's almost impossible to spoil it, not only because you're told what your main mission is within about the first 45 minutes to an hour, but also Zelda sort of canonically as a series is about these three individuals being reincarnated across time and having pretty much the same fight over and over again.
The game is very clear up front. This is what you've got to do. You can do it whenever you like. And so a bunch of Zelda's, this particular game story is actually about how you tell it to other people. When this game came out, a lot of people talked about, oh, I did this first. Oh, I found this thing. Oh, I went and saw this. Oh, I didn't go to Kakariko Village right up front. I didn't go to Impa. I went somewhere else entirely and missed all this context.
Absolutely. It's one of the great strengths of open world games in that the player can choose in what order they do things and how they want to do things. And by stripping away practically every single, say, story mission almost, and making this structure wake up, do the little sort of tutorial, and then that's your goal, you can get to it whenever you want, it really does give an enormous amount of freedom for how you want to approach it. You know, the game is designed so that they recommend, narratively, that you go around and meet all four of the champions who fell defeating Ganon in the first place, and they will directly help you, as well as giving you some greater understanding of the story, but you can just kind of run at him in your pants if you want. And if you're a speedrunner, you will almost certainly beat the game like that.
I think the interesting sort of narrative aspect of this game is not only like how you tell it, but a lot of it's about observation. I think Breath of the Wild observation ends up being the core verb. It's about seeing something, making a guess about it, and going and trying it. It's about finding things and seeing what you can do with them. Well, a lot of stories told by looking through a camera, finding those locations, and then seeing a short cutscene. But even beyond that, a lot of it's just seeing a space and wondering what happened to it, and seeing other things that help build up that context.
It's interesting to consider sort of what the world looks like compared to, say, Horizon, which is lush and full of things happening and people moving about, and 15's, which is pretty barren and desolate. Zelda Zelda manages to have quite an empty world, but that means that when you do notice ruins and stuff like that, they have a meaning and allow you, a bit like in Horizon, they allow you to sort of piece together what has happened, but also in meeting people and doing your own exploration, you sort of understand more clearly what the stakes are here in what you're doing, what exactly you're fighting for. Also, like Horizon Zero Dawn, this is sort of a game about preparation. In fact, also like Final Fantasy XV, the first two games we talked about, they sort of reveal slowly what it is the final fight is going to be and the main conflict. Zelda obviously doesn't do that, but all three games are sort of about you as a character not being ready to kill the final boss, from at least a mechanical sense if you're playing this the first time, and maybe for a narrative sense more broadly. In this one, Link has been asleep for 100 years and doesn't even have any trousers, let alone some decent swords with which to kill a demon king. So you are growing as a player in that you're a bit like Horizon, you're better understanding the world and even the literal controls, but that mirrors Link's own growth in getting back up to form and being better prepared for the fight that's happening. Unlike 15, though, this isn't a really urgent thing because 100 years have already passed. And I definitely remember thinking that because Zelda has managed to hold him off for a century, a couple of weeks while I find some decent armor and weapons, for example, is probably a reasonable thing to do. And a lot of the main dungeons, for example, or other main quests are explicitly so that you can better prepare for the final fight.
And even all of those, they've all been doing, like, all those areas and dungeons, the terrors that they're causing have sort of been done for long enough and everyone sort of adapted around them, it seems. The Rito are not in any particular danger from their particular threat. The Zora are unhappy that it's always raining, and there are some bad things that might happen if it continues, but none of the divine beasts are a huge immediate threat. And it's sort of reasonable to be like, I'll get to this when I can.
Exactly. It would be a very different story and sense of pacing, I think, if, for example, the Zora, who are fish people and thus, you know, a bit put out that it's raining all the time, but fundamentally they're all right with that. If you switch that with the camel that spews electricity and thunderstorms everywhere, you know, or you made it rain constantly in the desert and there are fireballs being spat at the bird people and it's freezing cold on a volcano. If you were to switch around sort of what the issues are, then this would be a very different game, because actually you would get to, say, the Zora village and you would see that people are dying very, very quickly. As it happens, instead, it's a big inconvenience that's affected their way of life for about 100 years, but it's been 100 years. They've managed to grow, as you said, they managed to grow and adapt around it. And so the benefit is understanding better who they are and what you're fighting for, but also getting a very literal helping hand when it comes to fighting Ganon at the end.
Going back to observation core verb, Breath of the Wild really encourages you to look at literally everything in the environment. Every single thing you can find is always going to be helpful to you. Finding random mushrooms is always going to help you. Cooking is a huge, huge asset in this game. And that's not important to the story, but with the game teaching you that it is always valuable to pay attention to everything, it helps you notice all the little things in the landscape, which helps you understand Hyrule as a character. And I think 15, yes, there are things to find in the environment. And the impression of Horizon Zero Dawn is there's lots of useful things to find in the environment, but they don't carry a lot of weight, is my impression. And in 15 particularly, you can sort of glaze past the landscape. You can literally just drive through it.
Yeah.
You don't need to walk through it. You don't need to pick up the things. It might be nice if you do, but it's not a huge loss if you don't. In Breath of the Wild, if you knew that you had missed a stamina mushroom, you'd actually be kind of upset because they're really, really useful. And I think that training you to always be on the lookout helps you appreciate the world design in a more thoughtful manner.
Yeah. Considering observation as well, while this game does stick with the sort of tower mechanic of revealing parts of the map, that, you know, you can go into them, but you won't really have a mini-map. A lot of it is based not on looking at the map and finding the icons. I think Assassin's Creed has always been, early Assassin's Creed games at least, have always been held up as a sort of the worst example of just giving you a map with icons vomited all over it so that you don't really need to explore anything. This takes completely the opposite tack, where you need to literally observe through your binoculars what's going on. It's quite, you know, and you're often making decisions, marking places that you want to go through looking through your binoculars rather than studying a map.
Or even literally studying the map and studying the topography and being like, there's a mountain point I haven't been to, I should go there. Or there's a particular landmark that looks like a heart shape and it's like, oh, that seems interesting, I should go there, that you see on the map and you wouldn't see from just looking on the overworld itself.
I remember hearing, I can't remember really any of the source for this, but the developers thought very carefully about hills in this game. Obviously, there's a big climbing mechanic as well with the mountains, but they thought very carefully about places where you might look. So I suppose the earliest example you come across is as you leave the cave right at the very beginning and you get that enormous, gorgeous, sweeping view of pretty much the whole of Hyrule. They really thought about sort of points where players might put themselves to try and get a better look and sort of hid certain things behind hills so that you wouldn't really be able to just stand on the top of a mountain and get a whole sense of what's in the world. Instead, you're going to need to look at things from different angles. And as you progress and you basically appear at different places in the world, you realize that certain things are there that you might have missed, you know, traveling east to west and the southern part of the map. When you start going across Hyrule Field in the northern half of the map, for example, you'll actually see those things that were hidden before.
It's like a great sense of progression, like this understanding of the space, because even though you're going back and forth a lot, you're always seeing new things.
On a more personal note, it's one of the few games that I've pretty much finished it, and yet I can just go and sort of relax climbing some mountains and finding some beautiful spots to look at. You know, they've really built up the world itself as a character that it's sort of a character that's its own system within which you are moving and acting.
Even going back to it to start from the beginning a little bit for this episode, it was going back to it felt very familiar, but it was like since I'd gotten so used to it and spent so long away from it, it was this real sense of like rediscovering things or getting to things in different orders or angles or seeing things in different context to how I saw them originally. And thinking of sort of endless newness, I guess, our next game is Final Fantasy Lightning Returns, which approaches this from a very different angle. Lightning Returns Final Fantasy XIII is a 2013 open world RPG by Square Enix and Triace. Lightning Returns is the third game in the Final Fantasy XIII trilogy, which is an odd phrase to say. And it's about the last days of the world and been placed back on Earth by God to save people's souls before the world is remade anew. A little bit of extra context is the world has been in a sort of stasis for about 100 years where no one has aged. So Lightning Returns very quickly has both this lack of pressure because the world has been in stasis for about 100 years and nothing has really changed, a little bit like Breath of the Wild, but also you have a very literal time limit. You start off the game with about 6 days to save as many souls as possible. And you're given 4 or 5 key locations to try and target, which are going to be very important souls to save. But the game really emphasizes very early on that you need to save as many people as possible and that it really is a numbers game. You have this very strong conversation with a side character almost immediately, where he tells you maybe you want to help out the big difficult problems, but we're really playing this for getting as much of this soul saving resource as possible. You should try and help as many small people along the way and maybe ignore some of the bigger problems.
Yeah, it's very much a case that the sort of main antagonists, bosses of each area are still generally just one person. It's more of a case of they themselves are causing a bigger problem, but the solution when you do solve it carries pretty similar weight in soul terms as any other human being. You know, we're trying to collect as many human souls as we possibly can. It's something that really works very well with this main quest, side quest structure, which, you know, we've come across in all these open world games, really.
Yeah, it sort of makes them a lot more level. Like, it still makes clear these are the important things to do, but it does mean that narratively, there's more of a reason for our protagonist to go around helping all these very random and often very minor issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Horizon Zero Dawn, for me personally, has probably the best sort of reasons to do side quests because it really gives you some story meat, which you might not get otherwise. But Lightning Returns doesn't just give you sort of some extra story. It gives you genuine narrative and gameplay justification to go and do these things, that you will literally get more time to finish the game and do the things that you want to do.
Yeah, that's right. So you start off with about 5 in-game days and you can end up with a total of 13 in-game days by the end. Literally is doubling the length of playtime you could potentially have in this world. These quests really offer, mostly outside of the core 4 or 5, very little narrative. Most of the side quests in this world are very silly. Like, they are the kind of quest that honestly, we could see articles writing about how silly this quest line is in any other game. And Lightning sort of plays the straight man, or straight woman in this case, I guess, to this like inherent weirdness of open world games. Because it is strange that someone asks you to go get 10 wolf pelts. But in this game, Lightning does comment about it quite a lot. And it is that sort of lampshading where maybe they should have done something else. But I think it's very interesting that they are making it sort of the joke of the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Because as with several of these other games, Lightning is sort of, she's thrust into this role as the savior, as a sort of representative of God to try and get as many of these souls as possible before we make a new world. But she is herself sort of understanding more about her position. As you mentioned, there's an early conversation where it's recommended that you don't overlook these small people. And I think once you start to do a lot of the side quests and realize, you know, yes, there are some enormous monsters to be killed, and there are returning characters from the series who need to be interacted with in really interesting and sometimes quite shocking ways, that's only part of your job description. Your job description isn't really that you can make amends with people, it's that you can save souls. And sometimes to save souls, you need to find someone's lost cat, or you need to get some wolf pelts, or you need to find someone's dad who only seems to appear at a certain hour in the day. You need to do some, yeah, sometimes quite minor and silly things, which are then given their own justification by the fact that that's your job, rather than having to rely on story development or something like that to try and push the player maybe a little bit more organically or secretively into doing these side quests.
So there's this time loop we've talked about a few times, and that, I think, ends up giving a lot of your actions a little bit more weight, because unlike, say, Final Fantasy 15, where there is an almost infinite amount of side content and you can just do it all at your leisure, in Lightning Returns, while you've got much more time than you ever really need to do it, everything in the game, there's the fact that it costs you a resource to do everything really gives it a little bit of extra weight to even the more small things you help with.
Absolutely. It really foregrounds this player choice, which we spoke about, I think most recently we spoke a lot about it in the Zelda game. It foregrounds the idea that, yeah, you are free to do whatever you want, but it's a choice that you're making, and that choice will have a consequence in that it will potentially prevent you from doing other things.
And one of the very interesting, I assume it's more accidental than deliberate, but as you progress, you end up dealing with most of the content in the game, so there's less quests to do, which provides the world with a sense that it's not really as alive as it was when you first arrived. And given you are literally coming to the end of days for this universe, that's a very, like, interesting, weird bit of harmony that's going on. But also, there's this very unusual mechanic. In most RPGs, you have effectively unlimited enemies that will keep spawning and attacking you. In Lightning Returns, there is a hard cap on how many enemies of each type you can kill. When you kill all but the last one, you get a super version that then gets you a very good accessory, which ties into your progression as a character mechanically. And then that enemy type is gone forever. And you can do that to basically 99% of all monsters. Every area has like one or two spawns that are usually mechanical in nature and are unlimited. But everything else, you can extinct. You can end up making the world a barren, lifeless wasteland, more or less, that is only filled with content people.
Yeah.
Not happy people, but content people. And it's kind of unnerving to get a game where you can sort of exhaust it in this way that is like weirdly narratively harmonious.
It makes a really interesting contrast to something like Zelda, which we praised for really having a sense that you exist in this world that continues on around you. In Lightning Returns, that balance is really tipped that actually not only do you know and sometimes can't quite convince other people that the world is going to end in about a week, you have a very real power to shape what that world is going to look like at the point of destruction and what world is going to come next.
The game doesn't talk about much about that next step in a lot of detail. That's sort of all very much backloaded for a lot of it, and your ability to influence that is in the discussions is very minor. I guess the other narrative thing that's interesting is that a lot of 13's a lot of Lightning Returns' main plot is told through the constant flow of time. Like every time a day ends, you return to this magical space, the Ark, where you return all the souls you've collected to hopefully get you extra time or rewards. And usually in this time, you have a conversation with the main antagonist-ish character, I guess. And so you have, in this game that is very open, through the natural structure of it being like a linear set of time that is finite, it just throws you at certain plot points that are sort of contextually sensible, I guess.
Yeah, again, it's learning more about your role. In the previous game, Lightning gets chosen by a different god, and at the end of 13-2, she gets turned into crystal and basically put in stasis, in a similar way to what happens to Link, actually, and gets woken up and kind of just given her job and sent down to Earth and off you go. And so, yeah, it's revealed in these fixed points at the end of each day, which by bracketing these times when you've got freedom but a limited resource of time with these very fixed points, with often cutscenes in it that you can spend as long as you want, but there's not really a lot to do. Again, it really emphasizes, I think, in your mind that you have choices to make and that you have things to work out and priorities to organize in what you're doing and how you're playing the game.
And it also keeps a sense of forward momentum going, which in games like, well, Breath of the Wild, 15, and Horizon, it's very easy to sort of just keep doing side content. Lightning Returns, at the very least, at the end of every day, you get an important narrative beat from you and Lumina, sort of this pseudo antagonist. So that really helps, I think, keep you interested in the plot and keep the plot relevant to you. Whereas in my experience of 15, at least, it was very easy to just get in that loop of camping and fighting and camping and fighting and sort of just put the main story to the side.
Exactly. You can get so focused on the road trip that you sort of forget that there is a world to be saved here. And Lightning Returns never lets you forget that, even while offering you freedom in these quite clearly defined chunks.
And so I think that might wrap us up for Lightning Returns. And so our last game takes a bit of a huge shift. A lot of these have had big epic fantasy sort of themes. Our next game is much more down to earth in Yakuza Zero. Yakuza Zero, a 2015 action-adventure that was localized into English in 2017, published by Sega, and part of the long-running Yakuza series featuring Kiryu and Majima and their entanglements in the Japanese mafia. What's very distinct about these games compared to, or the series compared to everything else we've talked about, is how incredibly small scale these open worlds are. The rest of these games are like continents, countries, kingdoms. Yakuza Zero isn't even a city. Yakuza Zero is a small suburb of Tokyo and a small suburb of Osaka that are based on very famous real life districts, but a little bit fictional for the purpose in their narrative. In real life, these spaces, you and I could walk them in less than 20 minutes, probably.
And I have.
Yeah, and I haven't done the Tokyo version of this district, actually. But yeah, they're incredibly small worlds, but are incredibly dense. Like, literally every building in them has a purpose. And often the purpose is just, it's a restaurant. It's a supermarket that sells supermarket food. But by making every building be actually a relevant building to something, and often they're not supporting the narrative in any way, like it never is relevant to the story that you can play with slot cars in one of the bars. It is never relevant that you can play Virtua Fighter in the arcade. But all these things make a space that is incredibly rich and dense and appealing to be in, and that feels like a home that is worth learning about. Breath of the Wild, like, encourage you to be observational by training you that there's lots of value in what you can find, and that just made you naturally more interested in paying attention and maybe spotting interesting narrative things. Yakuza Zero, most of the things in most of the buildings are not relevant ever, but it's so dense that you just know there's always something to find. And this is really emphasized in the side stories. At various points, you'll meet like random people on the street and they'll present often a very silly problem to you, like a group of band people who they want to look cool and they, you know, they say, you're a big tough guy. Can you tell us how to be cool because we're really all kind of geeks? And so you give them advice and, you know, you try and be like the helpful underground mafia type. And it's very silly because it's in huge contrast, because all these like little silly things you see going on in the district, all the little things that you can do in the shops in your free time, is a huge contrast to the incredibly serious Yakuza style crime drama that you are watching in the main cutscenes. So you watch like the first 2 hours or so of this game, I think, is your context for it. And you can agree, like, in those 2 hours, like, There's a bit of silliness, but it's mostly telling this rather severe plot.
Yeah, it's pretty gritty. And in fact, at least at the start, that density that we talked about, that you talked about just now, is, you know, that's an aspect of the story, that you're fighting over this one empty lot in the middle, that if someone can grab it, that means they actually own a full proper block of land, which then can be sold on for an enormous amount of money. That density really pervades through the literal story, as well as how you move through this world.
And even you as a character can get into the real estate market as one of the many minigames, which, given the plot kind of all revolves around the real estate in some sense, these minigames all help give a sense of this district being a real place. It's Japan in the late 80s, and so there's excess of money, and so people are doing all sorts of things, like, you know, karaoke is everywhere. And if you've lived in Japan for any length of time, as both you and I have, you know that karaoke is everywhere. An incredibly important part of life here. And so while all these little extra details in the world may appear like frivolous nothing, they all really enhance this space being a truly believable location. And in a city, how you approach that is very different to how you approach that in a post-apocalyptic fantasy universe, like Zelda and Horizon Zero Dawn. Horizon Zero Dawn would be very weird if it was filled with restaurants and karaoke bars, I imagine.
Yes.
And Breath of the Wild wouldn't work with a real estate market minigame because there are four towns in the entire world.
It's an interesting reversion in a way, because particularly compared to Breath of the Wild, where you're really exploring and you're searching, seeing things in the distance and coming to them, the fact that Kamurocho, it is?
Yes.
In Yakuza is so small and dense means that actually, in my experience, the story beats and the side quests, they come to you because you bump into them as you're working your way through these small streets.
It's impossible to avoid them because it's so dense. But because it's so dense, also, like, you see some things like, I can't deal with that now, I'm doing this thing. And because it's so dense, you can't notice everything the first time you go by somewhere. So we talk about in Breath of the Wild, like, you go from north to south, and that's very different from going south to north. This is very much the case in the Yakuza franchise. Like, it's too dense for you to ever truly notice everything you walk past. And so, as you progress over time, you start to notice more and more of the things. So even though it's a very small space you're working with, it expands in your mind as you spend more time there, much like any genuine real world place.
Does that sense that you really come to know and understand this really small area, does that come into the narrative at all later on? As I said, I've only watched about the first 2-3 hours.
So I think a really important part of the narrative is how much this space matters. If the location doesn't matter at all, then Kiryu's actions don't really make a lot of sense. So a lot of it is, I think, making Kiryu feel like a part of this place by having it be so dense and having it be a place where you can see this protagonist wanting to spend time in. And so by extension, he cares about it and you learn to care about it too. But a lot of the time it doesn't. Like, one of the really fascinating things about Yakuza is its management of tone, in that Yakuza is very quick to shift from being incredibly dark and gritty and serious to being incredibly silly, but still feeling cohesive, which is a very impressive, like, balance to manage. And I think the story is too gritty to, like, want to be dealing with it all the time in that very serious manner. And I think it's the silliness in the side quests and things helps, like, create a balance that makes Kiryu more human. I think that's what a lot of these little activities he can do makes him feel like a much more human person than the story itself lets him be.
Definitely, he seems to be very monotone, tough guy in a lot of the main cutscenes. But yeah, as you said, he's got to deal with some geeks who want to form a band and look cool or things like that. And I think it's probably significant that the areas that you're working in are entertainment districts. You know, the times that you're spending wandering around are places that the sort of NPCs and the other inhabitants of the world, that's where they're going to relax as well. Except for a Yakuza, this is kind of where you work. This is your bread and butter.
Yeah, very much so. Kiryu is in this interesting position in a lot of the Yakuza games, in that he's part of the Yakuza, but often he is fighting the bad Yakuza. And the games are, in a topic for a different discussion, are sometimes criticized for sort of overly glorifying the Yakuza and, like, portraying this image of most Yakuza are the good noble kind, but that they deal with the bad Yakuza. But that is a very different discussion for a very different time. Yeah, so like it makes this space very homey, and even though it's a space that is also where all the antagonism comes in, I guess. And that's what I think makes, yeah, Yakuza 0 very different to these other games. Was there anything else you noticed in your watching or in the things I've commented on?
No, I think that's all good, actually.
Well, then I think we might look towards wrapping up.
So I didn't get to speak in the introduction, but that means I get to go first when we're starting to summarize. So in this podcast, first we spoke about Horizon Zero Dawn, the best margarita pizza of open world games. It's a game that's narrative driven, but still very tightly put together so that everything informs that narrative. Next, we moved on to Final Fantasy XV and looked at the concepts of ludonarrative dissonance and harmony in the same game, and also questioned what kind of stories are best told in open world games. Third, we looked at Breath of the Wild, the idea of a world as a character, observation as a sort of controlling verb of how the player moves through it, and the idea of a game story set in the past and how that interacts.
And then we looked at Lightning Returns Final Fantasy XIII, and looking at how it actually made some of the inherent contradictions in open world games and storytelling a core part of the actual structure of the game, as opposed to trying to solve them via other means. And in the end, we looked at Yakuza 0, which took a different approach to open worlds, as opposed to being about a huge large space. It is instead about a very small dense space and getting to be intimate with that instead. And we hope that in looking at this discussion that you maybe look at open world slightly differently the next time you play one, and maybe you think how it is using that open world specifically to tell its story, or how its open world in fact contradicts its story. And thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You've done some writing, of course. Would you like to plug your various social medias or some good writing that you've done recently?
Yeah, sure. So we actually met at Bit Summit in Kyoto a year ago, and then again this year. My coverage of that event is up on startmenu.co.uk. You can also find me on my website, www.jackngrichardson.com, and on Twitter at jngrichardson.
And you can find all the regular platforms and pitfalls, social medias and emails and my own and Blue's in the show notes. And we'll be putting all of your information in the show notes too.
Thank you.
So that everyone can easily reference that. And we thank you for joining us today, and we thank you, the listener, for listening to us.
Thank you very much.